Sam Leith writes for the oldest surviving weekly magazine in the world, an organization which started publication in 1828, which means the magazine for which he is also the literary editor, The Spectator, are on the doorsteps of a famous double century in just 4 years' time. While also contributing a monthly column on gaming, over the course of 30 years, Sam has written hundreds of book reviews, well over in fact. He's authored multiple books himself, but as well, Sam hosts one of my favorite podcasts titled Book Club, where, in a similar fashion to this very show, but with much better execution, Sam talks with interesting authors about their books. Sam's also got a new book scheduled for release later this year and available for pre-order, The Haunted Wood, A History of Childhood Reading. And although we don't discuss it directly in this podcast, if you like the way Sam talks and the way he thinks, then you might be keen on checking that one out as well. But in this podcast, we non-exclusively discussed Sam's fifth book, You Talking to Me, which is a book on rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. And so, as you can imagine, I brought up Christopher Hitchens immediately as a reference for good rhetoric, but in the podcast, you can also expect a breakdown of ethos, pathos, logos, what makes some of the great speakers great, and references to Obama, Churchill, Martin Luther King, and many, many more for what made specific things they said stick so deeply. Now, pump your good juice with 5 stars as a review into this podcast. Sign up to the newsletter as the top link and enjoy the brilliant Sam Leith.
Oh, God, that's very hard to say. I mean, the best talkers, I mean, it's a cliche maybe to say, or it's kind of a very obvious answer to say, you know, I still think Barack Obama is extraordinary. Though, as my old friend Philip Collins, speechwriter, said, he's not even the best speechmaker in his own family. But I think Obama was what inspired me, actually, originally to write that book about rhetoric, because, you know, I just saw, wow, this was about 2008, and I saw this guy who was using unashamedly and virtuosically all those kind of rhetorical tricks and tips that I had long previously in my undergraduate career kind of taken a shine to. And I was like, wow, here's somebody being intentionally using a rhetorical high style and being really good at it. And what's more, it yielding, this being 2008, you know, some real results for him. Mm-hmm. And I think he's still extremely good in a weird way. You know, his sort of nemesis and antipode, Donald Trump, has a sort of effectiveness as a communicator, though it's in a very different sort of style. He's a sort of anti-rhetorical style. It isn't, you know, a purposely unpolished style, but one that's nevertheless itself very, very rhetorically effective. As far as good writers, my God, I mean, you know, I do that for a living, and yeah. There are too many to count. And I think you always, and this is one of the kind of points I've always tried to make when I'm talking about rhetoric itself, and indeed language in general, in the book I wrote about the written language, which is, you know, you can't really say whether somebody's good in isolation. It's more, you know, for a particular task. You know, you're comparing apples and oranges sometimes, because there are any number, you know, when you say a good communicator, I mean, there are lots of people who I think are terrific writers, but who may not be communicating to an end.
That's the distinction that some, I'm looking, you know, for. Good communicator, irrespective of how good their prose is.
Exactly.
Can they deliver a message?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what's of good examples of written communicators who are very lucid and clear. I'll probably have to come back to you on that. I mean, there are a number of journalists who are terrific. And I think journalists generally are actually weirdly where you look for, or where you're most likely to find, you know, very good people in the business of direct communication, because that's their mm-hmm. absolute bread and butter. They need to get stuff across quickly and make it, you know, if they're comment journalists, they need to make it persuasive and entertaining in a very short space of time. They absolutely can't rely on a captive audience in the way that, you know, the people who are writing, you know, internal policy documents for corporations can, or, you know, dictators can. And obviously literary writers are in a different game. So I think probably, you know, look at probably The New Yorker, places like that, The Spectator, you know, that's where you'll probably find some of the best communicators alive, I think. They're really, you know, the really good journalistic writers.
Are these journalists you're thinking of directly employing the lessons of rhetoric, or is it rather just through a long period of iteration of trying to communicate a message, they've somehow crafted it? Or is it just a direct, here are the employment of the lessons?
Well, I think it's mostly unconscious. I mean, my argument in the book about rhetoric is that rhetoric is a way of describing something we do. It's a sort of, you can certainly learn it. Aristotle said, you know, it's a techne, it's a thing that you can teach and learn and you can get better at it. Mm. But what you're doing is something, you know, we use language rhetorically from the moment we are able to use language at all. We're always on the make, you know. Yeah. I mean, and rhetoric really is just language plus power. And we've just discovered there are things that work. You know, we instinctively group things into groups of three, the tricolon. We instinctively, as I've just done there, we instinctively mm-hmm. use anaphora, where you use the same set phrase in the beginning of successive sentences. Yeah. A lot of those sort of stylistic tics of rhetoric are things that, you know, speech writers use them consciously, and mm-hmm. there are certainly people who will very consciously, you know, as craftsmen, go in and go, right, we need a tricolon here, we need to, you know, gussy this up. But a lot of the time, I think we have imbibed them so much that they become nearly as natural as breathing. We use those things in the spoken language as well as in the kind of written for speech language. And I think, you know, almost anyone who's a journalist will be familiar with, you know, you're writing a comment piece. Okay, find a way of bringing it, or even a long piece of reportage. You find a way of making your payoff somehow circle back to the opening line, or, you know, tie it up with a bow, and all of those things that become instinctive.
You mentioned the direct swing from rhetoric Obama to then really the opposite, anti-rhetoric Trump. Is it actually, I should check myself there. Is that even the case? Is that what it was?
Well, I've got it's probably too grand to call it a Hegelian view of the history of US presidents. But I tend to say they find one is a good speaker, and they become disillusioned with him and chuck him out and try and get one who can't string a sentence together. And then they get fed up with him and they go back to a good speaker. Yeah. And I think you could see to an extent, I mean, it's a kind of jokey point to take, but, you know, George W. Bush was notoriously inarticulate, though that didn't make him rhetorically ineffective, but he wasn't someone who sounded like he was in command of a fabulous high style. He didn't sound like someone who really knew how to use language in a conscious way. And, you know, W ended up coming to grief, as they all do. Obama suddenly looked great. You know, he was clever. He could talk. He knew stuff. Wonderful. You know, all that hopey changey stuff came along. Had Obama. Then obviously everyone came to mistrust Obama, because people do come to mistrust presidents after a couple of years. And, you know, we got Trump, who was, you know, very much the antithesis. But the point I would want to, I mean, you know, you said, and I think you were picking up on something I said kind of flippantly, that there's, you know, Trump is anti-rhetorical. One of my real baseline arguments, as I see it, about rhetoric is that what seems like anti-rhetorical stuff is also rhetorical. I mean, I've got a kind of Derridaean view of sort of wall-to-wall rhetoricality, that rhetoric, in my broad understanding of it, is really anywhere that language is involved with power, i.e. persuasion, and which is to say it's almost all language all the time.
Yes.
And you can appeal to people by seeming, you know, which is one of the, Aristotle came on this idea of the ethos appeal, how you present yourself to your audience. And one way to present yourself to the audience is as the guy who knows stuff. You know, you're an expert, you're smarter than the audience, you can lead them along, you can, you know, they can trust you because, you know, you're the person who's in command. Another way you can appeal to the audience is to seem like someone who's just honest and completely trustworthy and completely transparent. And, you know, the kind of one Locus Classicus of this is the great funeral oration off in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where Mark Antony says, you know, I am no orator as Brutus is, but as you know me all, a plain, blunt man, which is just You know, fantastic piece of cheek. Yeah. He's a much, much better orator than Brutus is, but he's already put his thumb on the scales by saying, Brutus, you know, he's doing rhetoric. He's fooling you. He's tricking you. He's playing on your emotions using these techniques.
Yeah.
And I don't use techniques. I speak from the heart. The moment someone tells you they're speaking from the heart, that is the most... It's like people claiming, this isn't political.
Right.
You know, I mean, in the same way that ideology... You know, suffuses, as Marxist critics will say, all of literature. You know, you can't say this literature isn't political because literature is political depending on what it chooses to omit. You know, a literature that omits politics. You know, as people have complained about, say, Jane Austen, they say, well, it's all, you know, surely it's just all about people having balls and worrying who's going to marry who. And so, well, of course, in order to focus on that, you have to pull focus from the, you know, gigantic slave-funded international society which gives rise to all this wealth and the best kind of thing. So that's the argument that Marxists make about ideology in literature, and I think the same argument can be made about rhetoricality, which is when you're trying to persuade somebody, saying you're not using rhetoric is itself a rhetorical sally. And you know why George W. Bush, much to the kind of frustrations of the coastal elites, you know, the fact that he said really stupid stuff when he opened his mouth and his sentences didn't really make sense didn't really harm him with the voters, because there's a sort of sense of if somebody seems like they barely know what's coming out of their mouth before it does, you know, there's a kind of Forrest Gump quality to that, that you think, well, okay, he may not be the sharpest tool in the box, but he's honest and he's decent and he's certainly, you know, if he can't put a sentence together himself, he's certainly unlikely to be tricking me.
Right.
Whereas people who are smooth, people who are completely in command, you know, who have sort of beautiful command of language and rhetoric, you know, like Obama, it can come to count against them, because you've got this, that guy's too smooth. That's kind of used car salesman patter. There's a sort of sense that I don't trust this guy because he's flyer than me. And and so both of those become rhetorical strategies. And, you know, Trump has that whole I am anti the smooth Washington coastal elites thing. And he's very, very good at mustering, you know, in the great triad of rhetorical appeals, pathos, which is to say emotion.
Okay.
You know, Trump speeches are designed to make you feel rage and pity, and he plays on an audience's rage and anger and, you know. And that I think, itself is very powerful, and particularly in the social media age where we know that, you know, again, and I guess we'll get on to this, but... You know, it's always old wine in new bottles. Rhetoric and what rhetorical strategies work absolutely adapts itself to its audience generation by generation. That means it also adapts itself to the means of transmission. And in the digital age, we know that the means of transmission is often social media and virality and so forth. And we know that what goes viral, what works, is emotional rather than, as it were, logical appeals. Yeah. You know, it's something that's short that makes you feel something fast and respond quickly.
Yeah. The rhetoric of Trump. As you analyze the way he speaks, do you think he's consciously using pathos rhetorically? Or rather, do you think it's just unconscious? This is how he communicates, and it happens to be along these lines of traditional rhetoric.
I think it's probably pretty instinctive for him. I mean, I don't want to get into a kind of, you know, always into your fault sort of thing, but I think he's obviously a person who has, if you like, quite poor impulse control, and who's quite angry or self-pitying quite a lot of the time. And, you know, cometh the hour, come the man. You know, he's sort of very well suited, as it turns out, to a particular form of, you know, media transmission and a particular kind of constituency that he was speaking to at a time when, you know, after 2008, you know, a lot of working class Americans felt that smooth Washington elites represented by the likes of Obama had, you know, sold them down the river. Everything had gone to shit. Yeah. The, you know, all the masters of the universe we were supposed to trust to keep the economy buoyant turned out to have been lining their own pockets, and it all went, you know, went to hell in 2008. I mean, that's, you know, that's sort of political point, but the sort of background to that is that Trump, admittedly, you know, there is the absurdity of his ethos appeal. He's you know, a supposed billionaire presenting himself as this kind of perfectly ordinary man of the people. But he's sort of, his ethos appeal is kind of clever, because it's, simultaneously buys into that kind of compensatory fantasy of, you know, that has long been remarked that the American dream, you know, is really a way of telling people who haven't got much money, you know, we have this wonderful free market and the American dream because everybody has the chance to get lots and lots of money. I mean, the fact that you have a vanishingly small chance if you start out poor in America from getting lots and lots of money. Nevertheless, the American dream becomes this kind of totemic compensatory fantasy for a very unequal society. Again, sorry, I'm not meaning to kind of drift massively into politics, though it does tie in with this. Because Trump presents himself as a sort of insider-outsider. He is the guy who's just like you, and at the same time, he's the guy who's got lots of money and all these hot chicks.
Lives in a hotel.
And lives in a big golden hotel.
Yeah.
And everyone goes, yeah, I'd like some of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's clever at positioning himself like
and
that.
In that cleverness, is it conscious or just instinctively that's how the man has communicated?
I think he's obviously cunning. I don't know whether I call him clever. I don't think he's got much book learning. I don't think he's, you know, probably reads a book from one year to the next. So the idea that he's been kind of scrutinizing Gary Wills's study of Lincoln's oratory and applied it to himself, as undoubtedly Obama did.
Right, right.
But the other thing that people have, I mean, there was a really interesting piece in, I think it was Vox, that got linguists to analyze Trump's speech style. Because, I mean, they, you know, you get kind of rhetoric guys and speechwriters and people like me to go, well, you know, that's a tricolon and look, he's using an afro here. And, you know, he does do all that stuff. Again, it's sometimes instinctively, sometimes when he's actually reading what his speechwriters have written for him, though he seems to improvise a lot. But the Vox piece had people who said what he's doing is very much what stand-up comics do. His way of delivery, and they said it's very characteristic, kind of New Yorkery, Queensy kind of thing, is that he doesn't finish sentences. And he very often he'll say, you know, he'll get halfway through a sentence and then as the audience sort of responds, he'll go, you know what I mean. You know, you know, and the audience comes to kind of complete his thoughts for him.
Oh, man.
And that kind of... It is. And I think it's... It is that stand-up thing, you know, where someone will start telling a story about their washing machine and they'll get halfway through and the audience will start to giggle in recognition because everyone's had a washing machine that's gone wrong like that. And he's like, you know, am I right? Am I right, guys? And that kind of am I right, guys thing, if you look at it in rhetorical terms, is a very good way of kind of co-opting. Partly it gets him out of legal trouble because very often he'll say, you know, the audience will say the bit that's the incitement to violence rather than him. But also it co-opts the audience as part of the speech making process. And that's absolutely central to the way rhetoric's always worked, that, you know, all rhetoric in some sense is identity speech, because it starts out with the speaker saying, this is me. And the speaker very quickly wants to try and make a connection with the audience, and that connection is almost always, you know, I'm one of you, this is us. This is why, you know, endlessly, you know, politicians do that thing, despite the fact that most of them, particularly in the States, are, you know, very rich and very weird and very unlike most of their voters. They'll nevertheless, you know, they'll put on a baseball cap, they'll eat a hot dog, they'll, you know, go hunting with an AK-47 if they're Republican. They'll, you know, in this country, in the UK, you know, if you're... For years, the gotcha question for a politician was, how much is a pint of milk?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you didn't know what cost of a pint of milk was. You don't understand the people. So the progress of a speech is almost always from me plus you and you and you and you and you to we. You're binding the audience together into one, and ultimately you're trying to co-opt them, their reactions, their, you know, you're riding the tide of their reactions. And, you know, good speech makers, they don't talk over the applause. They know when to pause to get a laugh. They right. start to play the audience, and the audience's response becomes part of the whole performance. And of course, the audience is not only then helping to perform, but it's sort of watching, you know, if you make your audience laugh, because crowds behave like crowds behave, the more people are laughing, the more people are going to laugh next time. And so it gets a kind of momentum. Yeah. And Trump's co-optation of the audience, so that they're all shouting, lock her up, or, oh, what's that? Let's go, Brandon, or any of these other kind of...
I haven't seen that one.
Tags.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they absolutely, you know, they become... They're part of a club.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of a club. And that that's powerful rhetorically, I think.
And it's different case to case, obviously, and they need to go hand in hand. But if you could put a percentage divide, how much of a good speech is its delivery versus how much is its written form, its construction?
Hard to put percentages. I would say probably like 70-30.
Delivery.
To delivery, yeah. I think it's all about delivery. In the same, stand-up comedy maybe isn't a bad analogy, which is, you know, George Carlin or, I don't know, Bill Hicks or Eddie Izzard could write you and me a routine and we would die on our asses with their routine. Right. And, you know, good material helps and bad material can hobble you. Mm. You know, if a speech is laden with cliches, if it's, you know, if it's self-contradictory in a very obvious way, if it's just clunks, it'll be harder to deliver. But honestly, you know, it's pure rhythm and music, really. And I mean, this is a point I make, actually, about even the written language, that so much of what sounds to us or seems to us like good writing is stuff that sounds good. It's just the cadences are right.
Right.
And that's kind of below the conscious level normally. And people who are good writers often just have an instinctively good ear for cadence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an example I use of this delivery thing and the speech making and sound. I remember a Secretary of State for Scotland in this country some years ago who said he was giving a speech. He was a Tory and therefore not a very popular Secretary of State for Scotland because it's Scotland's, you know, generally sort of Labourish and SNP-ish. But he said, "I am Scottish by birth, by choice and by aspiration." Got a huge round of applause. You know, one of my, he's not just Scottish once, he's Scottish twice, he's Scottish three times.
He must be very Scottish.
Yeah, he must be very Scottish. He's one of us. And there's a lovely rising tricolon, birth, choice, aspiration, dum, dum, da-da-dum. Mm-hmm. You know, just like the opening chords of Back in Black by AC/DC. It's got that lovely rhythm. But of course, if you're Scottish by birth, you have no choice about being Scottish because you were born that way. And you're Scottish by choice, you can't therefore be Scottish by birth. And you aspire to be something that you're not, but would like to be. So you're simultaneously saying, "I had no choice but to be Scottish. I chose to be Scottish, and I'm not Scottish, but I wish I was." Absolutely nobody paid any attention to this.
So it was true,
you know, nobody laughed out of court. They just applauded him.
Right.
Because the rhythm was right, and people aren't really listening to the words. They're looking at how confidently you're standing. They're looking at whether you seem to be enjoying yourself, or whether you seem nervous. Are you cringing? Is there blue on the stage? What's the, you know? And, you know, the reason confidence tricksters, you know, succeed in their tricks is because they're confident more than because they're tricky. Right. And I think that's, I mean, I don't want to kind of, you know, reinforce this age-old association between rhetoric and confidence trickery. But confidence is a lot of delivery. And, you know, you could, I mean, George W. Bush is another good example. He gave a speech in which he said, and I think I'll try and remember the quote exactly, but he said, "Hope is where our wings take dream. Families is where our..." Anyway, it was complete fucking gibberish. And yet, the rhythm of it was okay. It contained these emotive words: hope, families, wings, dream. It didn't really matter that there wasn't a logical connection between them, you know.
Right.
And so the sort of smart-ass people like me who are, you know, writing little instant reactions to political speeches and will say, "Oh, this sentence didn't make much sense," or "Oh, I see these paragraphs contradict each other." You know, that basically, that's farting into a hurricane. If the politician delivered it well, it will probably have worked fine.
Which is why routinely in any democracy, we're sort of selecting, we're optimizing for charisma more than substance a lot of the time.
I think 100%. And I that doesn't mean to me that we need to, you know, sort of abolish democracy altogether and get a sort of platonic style, you know, selection of philosopher kings. You know, all of him would be decided on by Dominic Cummings. That seems to me a bad idea. I mean, I take the view that, you know, the Athenians were on something that democracy, as Churchill put it, is, you know, the worst of all systems of choosing government, except for all the other ones that have been tried. But absolutely, you know, the way we've set up democracy in most of the Western world, it does optimize for charisma. There is an idea, at least in the UK, that you get charismatic politicians and you have hopefully very uncharismatic but extremely attention to detail-y civil servants who, you know, work on policy and, you know, there's a kind of little yin and yang going on there. You know, I mean, we fortunately don't. You know, it's not quite as stupidly constructed as all that. You know, we do have this idea that you know, you need a secretariat as well as an executive and you need people. You know, you need some counterbalances to the flashy lunatics. But undeniably, the flashy lunatics have the upper hand. And in recent years in the UK, the flashy lunatics have been given the, you know, solemn and sober people of the secretariat a really good shooing in public.
Yeah.
So it's tricky. But yeah, we do optimize for charisma.
Emphasizing the delivery, I brought up this guy with you before we were recording, Christopher Hitchens. You watch his videos on YouTube, or at least I'll speak personally, watching his videos on YouTube, absolutely loved it. Thought, this is the best speaker I've ever seen. I admire it. I emulate it. I want to recreate it. And then as I've grown older and revisited a lot of these debates he does, you realize that it is actually charisma driving it and not necessarily substance, particularly in some of his religious debates. There's a great video online that looks at the sophistry of Hitchens in a lot of his arguments against God. Which isn't to say, you know, he's not on the right side of the argument, in my opinion. But nonetheless, it was pure charisma, pure audience work that drove him through what was actually an empty point.
I think that's true. I think that's a fair criticism of Hitchens. I think he was very clever. I think he does coast a long way on passion and audience work. I think, weirdly, he's had a sort of second round of super celebrity almost posthumously, because he fits very well into that. Because he's so aggressive, and rivetingly so, and articulate in the sense that he's aggressive, but he's never inarticulately aggressive. The aggression comes through in an absolutely, I mean, you know, logically, it may jump from step one to step three, but in terms of the sort of verbal torrent and the apparent precision, you know, he never misses a beat. The sentences are all in place.
Absolutely.
And that means that he is perfectly tooled for this, you know, again, we're now opening onto a wider question about the way that democracy and the world is affected by the means of transmission and the media we've got. You know, that genre of social media video, which is all like, watch Christopher Hitchens destroy.
Yeah.
And you get those kind of YouTube videos. It's, you know, Jordan Peterson destroys, owns, you know, hammers. And it's always, you know, 10-second clip.
Some college student. This gets eviscerated.
Exactly. Some college student is eviscerated. And, you know, it's got sort of Mortal Kombat finishing move, you know, crudely photoshopped onto it, which, you know, some would say is not necessarily the ideal way to go about deciding on whether something's true or not, or the comparative merits of a complex case. But there is a lovely story that I think it's in Amos's memoir that he introduces someone to. I think maybe Amos introduces his dad to, it's Julian Barnes and Christopher Hitchens, and Kingsley goes, now, are you the one who can talk but can't write, or the one who can write but can't talk? Which, and I think Julian can now talk quite well, and I think Christopher Hitchens' writing was never as elegant as Amos's or Barnes's, but, you know, he was the talker, you know, actually, I think, in a way. I reread some of Hitchens' essays not very long ago, and I was kind of, not as impressed with them as I was hoping to be.
Okay.
You know, I mean, not, I don't know about logical aporia, but, you know, he's just not quite the stylist I think he's claimed to be.
And he might be remembered so just because of how forceful his speaking is.
Yeah, and his persona remembered, and his shtick.
His persona, I would say, for someone of my generation, is very typical. Our experience of Hitchens is via YouTube.
Yeah,
and exactly. Maybe written later. And so you can be drawn down a false lane of he's brilliant on every measure possible.
It's very, it's very interesting you say that generational thing, because, you know, dismayingly to me, you're like 20 years younger than me. And so you're absolutely of the generation that caught his YouTube fame, because I mean, he did. He certainly, you know, he was very celebrated for most of the, you know, last 15 or 20 years of his life. Mm. I mean, one of the things he did also, which is not to do with spoken or written, he was very good at choosing his enemies. You know, he went, like, I'm going to pick a good enemy. And, you know, he loved a fight.
Oh, so, they were worthwhile enemies. Mother Teresa.
Yeah, he went from, okay, who does everyone love? Right, Bill Mother Clinton. Teresa, we'll have her.
Yeah.
And then he went, right, the Elgin Marbles, that'll be worth, you know, 6 months of my time to kick up some shit. And Kissinger, you know, who's on the same side. But then he, you know, and when it came to the, right, the, you know, the famous thing that obviously put him on the outs with the left, was the Iraq War. But I don't think that that was a cynical career move, actually. I do think he was a believer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that people go, oh, he's just... I mean, he wrote that book, Notes to a Young Contrarian, which I think is a kind of, in a way, selling himself a bit short, because I think his publisher probably said, we want you to do a thing about contrarianism. Because I think he was interested in the idea that if you get too complacent in your position, you know, you should look at it from another one, i.e. be contrarian in the sense of kick the tires of your own prejudices.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was someone who was contrarian in the sense that he simply picked up a, you know, one end of an argument because everyone else was on the other one.
In Letters to a Young Contrarian, he disowns the title of contrarian.
Well, there you go.
Which in itself is very contrarian.
Exactly.
What a dick. But nonetheless, yeah, I think it would be incorrect to say that he simply chose the other side of that argument because it would be a good career move and it would get a lot of attention.
Yeah. And there were a lot of honourable people on the left who, I mean, they ended up with egg all over their face. But he did take the view. I mean, again, this kind of slightly ancient history for you, but at the time of the Iraq War, I remember I was commentator at a Telegraph, and there was a small but honourable minority of lefties who instead of simply going, you know, right, we don't like America because they're the big bad, and we're against wars because, you know, we're on the left and we think wars are bad. They all said, look, Saddam Hussein is like as big a fascist bastard as you will find on the face of the earth. And if...
As bad as they get.
You know, and sure, maybe the case for, you know, his connection to 9/11 is a little bit tenuous, but, you know, from an entirely Leninist point of view, you go, right, if W wants to stamp on this guy, we're in favour. And all the gays and leftists and women and trades unionists and, you know, ordinary people in Iraqi civil society will be very pleased to see the back of him. And why shouldn't we be in favour of it? Now, you know, the answer was, well, didn't work out quite how you'd hoped, did it? But which is to revisit a very old and sterile argument. But, you know, I think he took that position from an honourable and basically, you know, from the left.
Mm-hmm. Before we return to...
Yeah, sorry, we've strayed, but that's the nice thing about podcasts is you can.
Is there anything worth mentioning from your interactions with Hitchens?
I didn't have many interactions with him. I remember meeting him at a succession of parties where he was, you know, always kind of sweating whiskey, and he was always very charming and delightful. I remember somebody... A young Nick Lezard scurrying up to him at a party when I was talking to him and saying, I'm writing a book about The Simpsons. Do you watch The Simpsons? I'm trying to collect essays, a thing on The Simpsons, and Hitch saying, you know, I think The Simpsons is the only reason to own a television. And I'm kind of peeling across a field in hay, pursued by another old friend of mine who was desperately trying to have a drink with him. And he was like, no, I'm off. But actually the abiding... in-person memory I have is of seeing him on a stage, which is a good, I think it's good corrective to the, you know, Hitchens was, you know, always destroying and, you know, working the audience and hammering his opponents. It was him doing a debate, very stagey thing, with his brother Peter Hitchens, who, as you probably know, is, you know,
a weird
thing. Having started out as a, I think is just as much of a trot as Christopher, you know, became intensely conservative. In fact, exactly. he proudly calls himself a reactionary. Yeah. But the Hitchens brothers were doing an on-stage debate. And of course, the audience was 95%.
And you went to watch it?
I went to watch it,
Oh, brilliant.
Just sat in the audience. The audience was obviously 95% Christopher fanboys. Mm-hmm. I mean, I use boys advisedly, fan people, but, you know, let's face it, most of them are boys.
Yeah.
And... You know, Peter Hitchens, the so-called hated Peter Hitchens. I say so-called because he also calls himself the hated Peter Hitchens. Capital letters, passive-aggressive move. And Peter's very articulate, as is Christopher. And it was a really good debate. But the audience started booing and jeering Peter when he started to speak. And Christopher stood up. And I don't think there's, you know, there was not much love lost between the brothers, I understand it. And he just stood up and said, stop it. You're behaving like children. You're behaving like animals. Let the man speak. You know, this is not how we debate. And I thought, you know, good on him for telling his own fans off. Maybe a contrarian move, but...
Yeah, good on him for it. It's actually not a bad way to talk about rhetoric, analysing the two of them, because in my summation, Peter, although maybe he's articulate and I've admittedly never really read anything he's written, he has no charisma like his brother did. And so from a purely delivery point of view.
Yeah, I think he is actually very fluent and articulate. And he's a very fiercely, I mean, I often think some of his logic seems to me to be a little bit cockeyed, but he's very, you know, he's A, therefore B, therefore C. You know, his arguments tend to be quite logical. Mm. But he doesn't have, I mean, I think he's got a sort of prickliness, which is slightly, you know, anti-charismatic. Mm. You know, I mean, you like people who seem to be confident. Right. We all respond to people who seem to be confident just intuitively in our collective pits. And I think people who seem to be chippy or angry, if they're not angry, like on our team, you know, I mean, if you're angry and you're marshalling the audience's right, it's anger, it's great. If you're like, fuck you guys, it's me against everybody, that is a very isolating thing to project. Mm. And I think Peter Hitchens, who has sort of adopted, I think, quite cheerfully, the idea me contra mundum, you know, everybody's mad. Mm. The modern world needs dialing back to 1956. You know, leftists are all, you know, dangerous maniacs. Mm. People who smoke weed are, you know, a disaster. You know, the conservative government is of the UK isn't nearly what I'd call right wing. You know, I mean, he sort of basically thinks he's surrounded by, you know, communists and drug fiends and wasters and losers, and that, you know, society is on a high road to doom. You know, he likes being the prophet Jeremiah, but it's not, you know, being Jeremiah isn't a way to, I don't know whether that's the prophet I'm thinking of, might be.
I wouldn't know.
Anyway, he likes denouncing the evils of the modern world as if it's him alone on his pillar.
Yep.
And I think he's, you know, he's quite cheerful about that and he's quite effective. But as I say, it's not generally a way to bring an audience with you.
All right, let's return to the book. You made the observation that Trump is in the perfect age because these short little videos optimize for rage or violence and clicks. Jordan Peterson destroys college student, optimizes perfectly for the media consumption. If you looked at a pie chart of where all the media is being consumed, shorts is maybe more than the written word.
For sure.
You go on the tube, it's like people are TikToking 10 to 1.
And we even know that... I mean, you know, as I repeat, I'm a very old fart and I'm tied into kind of, you know, legacy media in which, you know, you write like 1,000 words in a newspaper, which is, you know, absolutely gone. But, you know, even I understand that if you're using social media, something like they found that on tweets, if it's got a picture, it travels much, 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 much further than if it's just text. Mm. And people respond so much more now to pictures and videos, and they're all very short because short stuff travels fast. And you know, like, it does worry me a bit because it does mean that anything that's complicated or that doesn't easily kind of get subtended into a kind of us versus them frame, or where there are complex trade-offs between risk and reward and various people's interests, which is to say most of the important politics worth doing, is just incredibly hard to make cases for in an age when a very quick, very shrill response is what, and you know, ideally a visual one, is what travels.
And this quote from the book, with that idea in mind, I think is quite strong. And I don't know if it's your observation or if it's Socrates, but this is the quote. Socrates was worried the written word would cause the art of memory and thinking to fall into disrepair. People would imagine that just because they've read something, they would know it. So, with that idea, furthermore,
isn't the same feeling relevant for the changing medium as we've just discussed in the shorts.
Yeah, I think, in fact, what I've just said is in a way a kind of like gold-plated example of exactly what I also, you know, attempt to treat with some caution, which is that every change in medium or technology is generally greeted with panic and, you know, a sense that...
A fear of loss
and a sense that everything's going to make us stupider. So, you know, when the theatre came along, you know, the Puritans thought that was a really terrible idea. novels were a terrible idea. You know, they were going to make young women stupid. And, you know, obviously the television, the Gogglebox, nobody was ever going to read books anymore. People were just going to become stupid because they watched television all day long. You know, David Foster Wallace watched millions of hours of television as a young man. And, you know, David Foster Wallace was quite clever.
He's so revered among authors.
Yeah.
Was he that good?
I think he was great. I mean, I love him because he was funny. He had a lot of heart and very good jokes. And he was very clever. He was a right show off, but he was... Hey, check out his essays. They're great. Yeah.
Sorry, but go on.
No. And, you know, likewise, in our own age, you know, I'm occasionally, as a sort of geeky, nerdy computer game person, going like, everyone says computer games and screens are going to destroy our children's minds. And this is, you know, it goes back to that, you know, essential, you know, Socratic mistrust of the written word because it would destroy memory. You know, each new technology has people saying it's the end of the world. And generally it's not. Generally it changes the ecosystem, but it does fit in. So no doubt the things that I'm panicking about, you know, nobody thinks joined up anymore. The internet's rewiring all our brains to be stupid is going to turn out to be, it'll shake out somehow. But I have to say at the moment, I'm definitely caught in that particular moment of thinking, Christ, is nobody ever going to be able to mount a proper argument anymore because someone will simply wave a Palestinian flag or accuse them of being a TERF and it'll all be over. You know?
Yeah. I mean, can you give any still man argument? What are the virtues for this changing medium where everything is short-term content?
What are the virtues of a medium?
Like, can you say something positive about it?
Well, I think one of the virtues, which is why, you know, it was interesting to me revising my book, is that social media, when I wrote the first edition of this book, it was kind of 2011-ish, hadn't really taken off. It was just starting its ascent.
Yeah.
And now, of course, it is the central fact in political and public, which is to say rhetorical life. Now, without question, it seems to me, the fact that now the potential to reach a vast audience is available to anyone with an ISDN line is a transformational and basically an extraordinarily good thing. I mean, you know, for most of the history of rhetoric, it was formal speech making in certain very limited venues. You know, you didn't have recorded, you know, you couldn't record things, you couldn't transmit things. So it basically, you know, if oratory was going to happen, it was going to happen in the law courts or it was going to happen in the agora or in the descendants of those things over the years. And it was going to be, you know, powerful white men of a very small minority in the West, certainly, who had the right to speak and could be expected to be heard. And in the, you know, 20th and 21st centuries, that has changed. And more people can speak and can find an audience. And, you know, the very fact that, like, you and I are engaged in a podcast in which neither of us, you know, is, like, super famous. You know, we haven't had to kind of go to, I don't know, the BBC to make it.
Right.
And it can go up online, and if, you know, people like it, any number of people can download it and listen to it. Is kind of transformation. You know, that's real, that sort of people power. You know, the spread of rhetoric and the spread of democracy kind of go hand in hand. So the democratization of rhetoric seems to me to be an unqualified good.
Yep.
You know, the fact that the forms in which it's currently transmitted tend to prioritize like shouty lunatics. And, you know, but we are having those arguments, aren't we? I mean, it's, it's interesting to me that you know, phase one was this sort of laissez-faire thing when everyone gets on Twitter, we've all got free speech, we all get on, you know, the internet or, you know, Substack or whatever, and proliferation of these platforms. Mm. And over the years, there's been kind of slight pushing back, and we're now seeing it. People are arguing about, you know, are we all leaving Twitter because it's full of Nazis? Mm. Has Substack got a problem with the content? And the kind of idea that, I mean, free speech has itself become a sort of shibboleth or a kind of a very live political term.
What's a shibboleth?
A shibboleth, sorry. It's become, shibboleth is a biblical story where they sorted the two different tribes. One of them pronounced the S in shibboleth more like S.
Okay.
And so when they were all pretending to be each other as refugees, I think I'm getting this quite wrong, but they were crossing a border.
Okay.
And they discovered that using shibboleth, you know, they'd make them say the word shibboleth, and the ones who pronounced it in whichever was the Midianite way or whatever, they let them through, and the rest of them, they put them to death. Sorry.
It's a way to say...
It's a way
to test whether you're legit or not.
Well, free speech has become such a kind of political football, really. It's become a term in which, like, for the right, you know, free speech, it's all about free speech. Right. So arguments about free speech and censorship, which are fundamentally, in some ways, arguments of how we control these spaces, whether the idea is you have completely laissez-faire attitude where literally everyone goes on the internet and says what they like, and corporations can lie, and, you know, false advertising, and, you know, all those sort of abridgments of free speech that we have traditionally had, you know, various forms of censorship, not all of which are malign. You know, because we have restrictions on false advertising, on libel, on the, you know, and we tend to say hate speech in various forms. I mean, some people define hate speech as, if you like, you know, you might say Holocaust denial or racist language in some territories would be regarded as prohibited speech. In others, it might just be bad taste. Mm. But most places, in, you know, most jurisdictions around the world, tend to draw the line in incitement to violence. So there are these kind of questions over how we police these spaces. You know, we've got these spaces, we know that things travel in a certain way, we know that the lie's halfway around the world before the truth's got its boots on. And I think we're now sort of starting, in the way that laws and regulations and institutions tend to play catch up with technology. And they play catch up through a process of sort of human reaction and conversation, sort of say, oh, this technology's got it over here. Okay, that's not an entirely good place. How do we make it safer and better? And I think we're seeing that happening. I think that what's, you know, as we sort of recognise that, you know, amidst all the kind of cornucopia of goods that the essentially unpoliced and unpoliceable free spaces of the internet have supplied us with, in rhetorical terms, you know, there may be some bad things that have come along as well, which is, you know, the disinformation, the signal to noise ratio, the presence of, you know, bad actors, and, you know, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not singling out Nazis, but, you know, we talk about Nazis as a sort of paradigmatic instance of, you know, people whose voices maybe we don't want to hear in the same way, but equally, you know, they're the kind of cancel culture mobs which the right tends to object to. So the way in which we start to kind of shape, and I think mostly shaping, not de jure, not through kind of state legislation and kind of heavy-handed stuff, even when that works, but shaping through a kind of common discussion about how we use these spaces, which spaces we choose to inhabit, how people's consumer behaviour can bring pressure to bear on platforms to keep their houses in order. You know, and I think the other thing, which I strayed a little away from your original question, which was about the formal question of this, like, small stuff travelling fast.
Yeah,
I think, weirdly, it's not quite as straightforward as just everything's in bits and bobs, because one thing we've discovered, you know, podcasts have become a big thing.
Mm.
You know, podcasts are all over the internet, and people listen to 2 or 3 hours of people talking about often quite complicated stuff.
Mm.
And indeed, long reads you know, people will Substack thousands of words of articles.
Which such an interesting paradox?
I think what it is that the way that people are using the internet is quite clever. So these like bitty, bitesy sites like Twitter. I mean, using Twitter as the paradigm because it's the biggest one and it's the one that I most do it. But TikTok maybe or Instagram. I don't know how much TikTok links to text. But I do know that for, you know, like a tweet, you embed a link to something bigger. And so people are using some of these small bitty things to transmit a kind of...
a little hook.
A little link, you know, a little look here to something that often will be very big. And people have, you know, the idea... I mean, I think it's a popular idea that our attention spans are all completely shot to pieces by the internet.
Yeah.
I think is... it's like a massive oversimplification and probably neurologically a bit shonky. I remember when Nicholas Carr wrote his book, The Shallows, which was sort of superficially quite impressive. And it was basically one of the first of those, woo-woo, the internet's making us all stupid because our brains are shrinking books. And he said, you know, the internet is physically changing the structure of your brain.
Nice.
And I think it took one critic to say, well, except... when you learn the piano, it physically changes the structure of your brain. That's what neuroplasticity is. You know, if you interact with anything in the world, it's rewiring your brain because rewiring the brain is what our interactions with the world does.
Sure, sure.
So I
each additional experience.
Exactly. Every experience, every memory, every habit, every, you know, everything you, every affordance or ability you acquire rewires your brain.
Yeah.
And likewise, Stephen Johnson's lovely book, Everything Bad is Good for You, which came out now many years ago, but in which he said, look, we all think that modern telly is making us stupid or that computer games are making us stupid. Or that, you know, and he actually went structurally. He said, well, look, television of the 1970s, you know, there was a completely linear plot line. Television of the 80s, you'd have two or three plot lines at most in a soap opera. If you look at something like The Wire or Breaking Bad or The Sopranos, there's like five or six different timelines. They'll, you know, the cutting's much more frequent. The amount of cognitive work that a viewer is doing is getting greater and greater and greater.
Interesting.
As television develops and becomes more sophisticated grammatically. And he said the same, you know, makes a similar argument about computer games. He says computer games, they actually require you to infer the rules of the game from within it. They telescope larger tasks within, you know, a whole set of tasks will telescope inside each other. So, you know, you find your way into the room and then you have to find the key to open the box, which allows you to find the other key to open the other box, which allows you to, you know, that, and that these games actually do exact, I mean, they may be a total waste of time, but they cause a lot of cognitive work.
Yeah, it's not destroying you.
It's not destroying your brain. He argues that all this stuff actually might account for the Flynn effect, which is the observable, but nobody quite understands, I think, at this stage, why that over the last 50 years or so, IQs in the West have gone up.
Oh, interesting.
Steadily, but surely. And he says it's just because our media is getting more sophisticated. I mean, I don't know whether that's right or wrong. So I don't think it's as simple as to say that, you know, we're all on social media and that's making us dumb. I think it makes us more connected. It allows the spread of information, not just disinformation. But, you know, people, we seem to have an appetite for binge-watching television 10 hours at a time.
Yeah, I think I've always never taken too seriously the idea that, like, TV's bad for you or reading a book is the only way you could responsibly consume some type of media. It's a very highbrow way to look at things. Like you say, The Wire. I learned so much about American culture. I learned so much about crime. It gave me sympathy, empathy, and entertained me the entire way.
Yeah.
It's like, it's much better than a book.
Well, also, I think the idea, again, I mean, it's just maybe a slight detour, but this anxiety, I mean, books, you know, books are my thing. Books are my professional life.
Evidently.
But the idea that people, the only way to take in text or language is through a book, the only proper way, seems to me to be just kind of philistine. I mean, and I can sort of see why in the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, people were worried about telly. Because to younger people, you know, telly is attractive and it's probably more attractive than the work you put into a book. Though, actually, I'm writing a book about children's literature and I looked into one of the reports they did at the time, and they said, in fact, they discovered that television didn't displace reading from children's lives. But you could sort of see why there was the anxiety. But it struck me that certainly in the, you know, of the millennial generation, like, kids are really, really immersed in text. They might not be reading dead tree books that much. Right. But the social media age was one that was saturated with text.
True.
Texting and emojis and, you know, text messages. You know, I mean, very, very few millennials and Gen Zs like to pick up a phone. They text. They WhatsApp. And obviously, you know, the sort of boomer anxiety was, yeah, but it's full of emojis and they'll... You know, they'll basically be incapable of, you know, writing a proper sentence when they're required to do so for an essay or a job application or whatever. But I don't think that's true either, because I think what we've got is a generation of children who are incredibly, children, young adults now, even older adults now, who grew up absolutely immersed in text and in text, in the written language, and who were very, very adept at what linguists call code switching. You know, they knew and have always known the way that we all instinctively know. You speak to your parents differently than you speak to your peer group, than you speak to your teacher, than you speak to the judge. You know, we all are masters of a whole set of different languages and registers. And rhetorical effectiveness is all about matching your language and register to your audience.
Right.
And we're all very good at that. And I would be very surprised, and I'm sure we'd have heard about it by now, if the generation that grew up texting each other, you know, the moment they entered the workplace, covered their CVs in smiley faces and emojis and, you know, abbreviated U to the letter U.
Totally.
You know, I think it's bollocks. I think they, I mean, if they're taught, you know, proper reading, writing, arithmetic at school, I think they will know how and when to use it as adults.
Right. Yeah. That's
actually really optimistic look of things, which I haven't heard elsewhere or consumed that opinion.
Yeah, well, it's kind of optimistic.
But it all completely makes sense as you say it. I think it's easier to have a knee-jerk reaction that.
Yeah, I mean,
everyone's always all bad.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I'm not totally complacent about it, because I think it is the case that.
And you've got two young children, so you.
Yeah,
see
I've got three young children.
Oh, sorry.
And yeah, you met two of them. You've been spared the third so far. I had, you know. I'm sort of very aware that the interactivity of, you know, our little pocket friends and the way that they are so ruthlessly optimized for, you know, dopamine feedback loops and, you know, someone's because they're a slot machine in a pocket. I think we can't ignore that actually elements of the stickiness. I think, you know, I know a bit about addiction, and I think there is definitely an addictive quality to them that is probably greater than, say, sitting in front of the telly was.
Right.
So I, you know, having airily dismissed the last moral panic, I don't completely dismiss this one. I do think there are issues with phone use, and, you know, I think it's probably not a great idea to let your kids, you know, just be on the phone 12 hours a day.
Right.
But I don't think that everything that they do, you know, I don't think just because you're consuming text on a screen,
right, that's the
doesn't mean you're engaging with language. If you're consuming no text on the screen whatsoever and you're literally playing Candy Crush 12 hours a day, that's, you know, that's maybe another thing.
When you initially wrote the book and also revised for the updated edition, did you come across Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death?
Oh, I know of it. I don't think I've read it.
Okay. I would highly recommend it. It kind of does fly in the face of everything you just said, but this was written in 1987. And it's incredible how prophetic it was, because he was just writing about how TV sort of rots political discourse and rots people's ability to make an argument. And you'd love it, particularly so for the forward or the epilogue, whatever, the opening to the book. It is so good. He basically says, we were all worried about 1984, when in fact it was A Brave New World that sort of won out in the end, where you will be happy by just zoning out to whatever the crap is in front of you. Anyway, but it's, yeah, I think 1987 when it was written, and it's phenomenal. And I think an updated version of that now would be a phenomenal bestseller.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, I funnily enough, you know, we mentioned David Foster Wallace. That's sort of the joke of his great novel Infinite Jest, is, okay, which everyone thinks of as an internet novel. It was a pre-internet novel. It was a television era novel.
Yeah.
In which there is this thing called The Entertainment, which is a film so ridiculously entertaining it kills you, because people start watching this videotape and they are transfixed by it. And the moment they stop, they just have to go back and watch it all over again. And of course, they forget to eat and they just, you know, die in a puddle of their own shit. And, you know, that's, as you say, you know, he had no idea what was coming down the pipe, you know.
Right.
So I think the stickiness of entertainment. I mean, in a way, you could read the Amusing Ourselves to Death thing as a reason for optimism, because, okay, if we were having the same panic about TV,
you know, totally,
maybe it's
what Aristotle said.
Yeah, it's back to the back
when,
to all the,
when the written word came about.
Exactly, but it's back to the idea that you know, everything's always making us stupid, but it's always making us, it's often making us clever in different ways that we might find.
Was it also Aristotle who was complaining about his grandchildren and how their generation doesn't respect their elders, doesn't clean up after themselves?
Oh, I don't remember that. But again,
it was one of the ancient Greeks basically said that, which is hilarious because...
Of course. Well, of course, they didn't know they were the ancient Greeks.
Right.
That's the thing that always does my head in thinking about Aristotle. At the time, he didn't think, here I am at the beginning of Western philosophy. He was just like, look at all this stuff. God, there's people around for ages, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's very hard to avoid falling into that idea that these people, they kind of knew that they were doing something completely different and new. You know, I mean, to us, they're like, oh, he was Aristotle. But he didn't know he was Aristotle when he was Aristotle. He was just a guy kind of wandering around being interested in stuff. Yeah. And I did, in the book that I followed up the rhetoric book with, which was more kind of a style guide, how, you know, tips for how you might use persuasion in, you know, basic English prose. I did have at the beginning a kind of list of all the people who complained the language is going to hell in a handcart. And like the first one in modern times is Caxton. You know, sort of 15th century, you know, English is utterly degraded and will soon, you know, we'll be barring like sheep and grunting like pigs and it's all and every single generation says, you know, English. And I think part of that, you know, we were talking about nostalgia earlier, part of that is just, you know, we don't like new stuff, you know, language changes, we like the way we were taught in school, we like to feel superior to people, so if somebody's saying, you know, less when they mean fewer, there are people of a certain generation and cast of mind who will go, oh, you know, that's just wrong. And, you know, young people today can't speak the Queen's English. But at the same time, you know, this person would struggle to get on with text speak or all of the other variants of language, which are fantastically useful to the young generation. You know, standard written English and formal English, you know, it does change also. It just changes a bit more slowly.
Do you find that... Actually, I forget that question. Let's return to definitional work almost. You've mentioned ethos, you've mentioned pathos. Could you just give us the rundown? What is ethos, pathos, logos, and why it's really the building blocks of speeches?
Okay, absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, I should probably have set out this stall much, much earlier. But this goes back to Aristotle, who, we're not complaining about his grandkids, formulated the original sort of, I mean, he's the first person who formally thought, how does persuasion work? And he said basically there were three ways, three appeals, three ways you persuade someone. And they always mingle in almost any piece of rhetoric at all. But they are analytically distinct. And ethos is the way that the speaker presents him or herself to the audience. It's the sort of what your bona fide is. Do you know what you're talking about? You know, do you project expertise and confidence? And above all, I mean, what's really important with ethos is not just the extent to which your interests coincide with those of your audience. I mean, which is why the basic ethos appeal, particularly in politics, is, you know, he or she or one of us.
Right.
But fundamentally,
I choose to be a Scot.
Yeah,
I aspire to be a Scot.
Exactly. You're talking to your tribe, and, you know, what you don't want, you know, if you're an audience listening to someone trying to persuade you to take a course of action or not take a course of action, you want to be fairly confident that whatever the benefits of the course of action to you, they're going to be the same as the benefits to the speaker. You know, you don't want the person who's going to, who wants to sell you this car because, you know, it gets the car off their hands, but you're going to crash the car because the car doesn't work. You know, it's like we've got the same, to take a Taleb notion, the same skin in the game. You want to feel that the speaker isn't pursuing a hidden agenda. So ethos is all about reassuring your audience that you have their good on your, you know, their interests at, close to your heart, that you know what the hell you're talking about, and that you're trustworthy. And pathos is the appeal to emotion. I mean, we use pathos now very often to mean, you know, the sad bit in films, but actually pathos is any sort of emotion. Right. And positive emotions, you know, hope, excited anticipation, you know, exultation and triumph. All of these are very powerful emotions, but equally the negative emotions work very well. You know, you, if you make your audience scared of the consequences of not doing what you want them to do, or you make them angry, or you arouse pity in them, or laughter. And laughter, I think, is a hugely underrated pathos appeal, because in the first case, anybody who laughs implies confidence. If you laugh at your opponent in debate, you've always got one over on them, whereas if you go white and clench your fists and look like they've got to you, you're rattled. And if you laugh or can persuade an audience to laugh, laughter is kind of involuntary. You know, you can't laugh deliberately.
True. Yeah.
And so laughter,
or if you do, we can sense you're not.
Exactly. And so laughter, as I think of it, is involuntary assent. If you laugh with the speaker, instantly that ethos work of, you know, we're all together, we're all as one, is done. And that's why I think you see on a kind of paradigmatic level, come back to stand-up comedy, the dynamics of a stand-up comic facing a heckler are absolutely about ethos.
Right.
If a heckler gets a bigger laugh than the comedian's stone dead. Because the audience is with the heckler, not with him. And that's why they get so bloody good at putting down hecklers.
Yeah. You know? True.
And because also...
stakes are highest.
And also everybody... You know, one of the things we... You know, I've said rhetoric is identity speech. Identity is, you know, every identity theorist in the history of the world will tell you, is all about, you know, not so much who you are as who you're not. Define yourself against another. You know, the classic rhetorical sally is find a common enemy. And... you know, in lots and lots of speeches through history, and lots of most consequential speeches through history, finding a common enemy is, you know, let's go and bash those bastards. You know, the Persians are coming, whatever it is. But in a, you know, comedy theatre, it's the heckler. Who's the enemy? Them.
Give us a classic example of pathos.
Pathos. Of...
pathos is emotion, right?
Pathos is emotion. Yeah. I'm trying to think of a classic example where you'd find one in the... Well, I mean, there's Obama's speech at the mass shooting. Do you remember where he started to sing Amazing Grace? He was giving a speech after a school shooting.
And he started singing.
And he started singing Amazing Grace in this oration right in the middle. And that's a sort of almost a cheat pathos because the moment, you know, song conveys an emotional current that's...
to sing unexpectedly.
To sing unexpectedly.
Yeah.
Partly, you know, having the brass bollocks to do that.
Sure.
Is, you know, you know, very high risk strategy, but also.
Did it work for him?
Yeah, it did work for him. But but song obviously is, I mean, not everyone breaks up with song, but pathos. But I mean, when Lincoln's Gettysburg Address is drenched with pathos. I mean, he's talking. I mean, it's got those elevated that language about, you know, four. Was it? I'm now going to remember 67, however many years it was. But he says, you know, we cannot consecrate. We cannot. Sorry, I'm going to have to. Maybe I should just.
It's right there, actually.
I mean, pathos is not, as I say, you know, it's very often conveyed, not, you know, because you don't say, I am cross. Or I am sad. I mean, you might do, but that's not often what carries it across to the audience. So it's not, you wouldn't say this quote is pathos very much.
Right.
It's more to do with sort of bearing of a speech, the type of language we'll use, the type of connection you'll make with your audience. But
The delivery.
A lot of that's to do with delivery, but let's find the... I'll just find the Gettysburg Address in here. Oh, yes. So in the Gettysburg Address, you know, it's Lincoln, obviously, consecrating a war cemetery. And he says in it, "We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here." And that, you know, it's absolutely kind of, I mean, partly its ethos is bringing the audience together and saying, but it's turning the art of mourning to political purpose. And it's saying in this humble way, you know, what can we do in the face of the sacrifice that these people have made? And that's undoubtedly, I think, a pathos appeal, that sacrifice is not an abstract sacrifice. It's one that the audience is meant to feel as an emotional loss. But almost whenever a speaker is trying to bring an audience to some sort of emotional pitch, that's going to be pathos. I mean, I think I seem to remember in the book I do use examples of very cheap pathos appeals, like the way that a charity will never, in its leaflets, send a sort of detailed breakdown of the effectiveness of its spending dollar by dollar. What it'll do is it'll give you a picture of a child, starving, it connects a human, puts a human face on something. And we do respond to pathos more than anything else. Logos is the one that comes in third position. And what's interesting about Logos, I mean, because it shares a root with logic, and you'd think that means it's all about, you know, the logic of an argument. It is about the structure of argument, but it was Aristotle, way back when, who noticed that logos and logic are slightly different things. And his argument was that logic proceeds by kind of mathematical, you know, by iron chains of inference. So you go, you know, as Plato would have, you know, we're looking at syllogisms. You know, you get your premise A, your premise B, and you draw a conclusion C. So, you know, Socrates is a man, all men are mortal. Therefore, Socrates is mortal.
Right.
And those things are absolutely, you know, a syllogism, there's no wriggle room in it.
Mm.
And Aristotle said, no, it doesn't work like that in rhetoric, because you're trying to persuade people. And if you're trying to persuade people something about the future,
right,
in deliberative oratory, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. You could say you're fairly sure that if you, you know, march into the next town carrying your axes, you'll carry the day and win the castle. But it might not go that way for you.
Mm.
And if you're arguing about the past in a court of law, again, you know, the phrase we use now is beyond reasonable doubt, because the past is in its way as unknowable as the future.
Mm.
And so he said the way we persuade people isn't with absolute logic. It's with not syllogisms, but enthymemes. And enthymeme is basically kind of half-assed syllogism. It's either a syllogism with a kind of hidden premise, or a syllogism that relies on probability rather than certainty. So logos basically is logic with a whole lot of wriggle room. And that's why rhetorical logic is bendy logic.
Right. So to surmise, ethos, pathos, logos, how can we think about trying to identify that next time we're listening to not only a politician speak, but, you know, maybe just someone who's trying to convince us of something?
Well, you can notice that generally the ethos appeal will be that, because rhetoric gives you a whole set of, you know, analytical tools for the structure of a speech, the, you know, the structure of sentences and words within it and so forth. But generally, you know, the ethos tends to come near the beginning.
Mm.
That's the speech, you know, like when a speaker introduces themselves, and that, you know, you think, what's
your credentials?
Your credentials. So you say, first of all, what story is this speaker trying to tell me about him or herself? By the way they dress, by the way they comport themselves, and what are they, you know, how are they describing themselves? How are they presenting themselves? And very often, particularly in political speeches, a speaker will tell a story. Mm. You know, they'll, you know, God, I'm weary of the, you know, American presidential candidates, you know, speeches, which always have some personal thing about how their own story is essentially the story of the United States itself. You know, they're always like, my mommy and daddy worked hard, and, you know, my, if they're immigrants, they are the, you know, immigrant, or they had immigrant parents, they are the American dream that way. They almost never say, you know, I was born to parents who are fantastically rich, and I went straight to Harvard, and I've never had to do it. Exactly. I mean, George W. Bush, it wasn't almost exactly, it was a hereditary president. Right. His whole thing, and he had a kind of quite charming thing. He knew, he always wear a Texan hat, and he was actually born in Connecticut, but he always said, you know, it was just an accident of birth. I was really a Texan, but my mother just happened to give birth to me in Connecticut, but really spiritually I'm from Texas. How, you know, you can just see what they're doing in lots of ways, not all of which will be actually directly verbal, to give you a picture of themselves and what they try and occlude and what they try and push forward. Logos, you're looking at how does the chain of propositions in their speech, and the best way of checking that one is, you know, if you can be bothered and you really care, download a copy of the speech's text and just read it a bit carefully, because then you'll be able to notice, you know, where the figures don't seem to add up, or where there's a leap of logic, or where one paragraph seems to contradict another. Because in the course of listening to it, it all washes over you, and it'll be sound effects, and you won't be able to see its structure. So, you know, getting at the logos is harder work normally, because quite often the logos is occluded.
So it's credentials, and then this is what I want to do, why it makes sense I want to do this,
and generally the pathos is very often what comes in the peroration at the end. It's not always the case. Sometimes people start out with screaming pathos, sometimes you know, I mean, very often if it's a very emotional event, there will be a, you know, I mean, again, it depends what sort of speech you're giving. But typically, you want to leave the audience with a feeling, because they'll remember a feeling much better than they'll remember a fact.
Yeah.
And that's why very often you'll see a speech might be quite logical and careful in the middle. It might say, look, there are three reasons we need to do this, and these are the reasons why, and, you know, my opponent's going to say this, but I need to rebut that in advance. That's where the logos comes in quite often. In the body of the speech, you advance an argument. I mean, not all speeches advance an argument, but in most deliberative speeches, the sort of speeches I guess we're talking about, an argument at some level is advanced. Most consequential speeches advance some sort of an argument, and they will pretty it up to make it memorable and to make it persuasive and to make it feel like it's coherent. I mean, that those tricks like anaphora and epistrophe, where you're repeating things, or tricolons, where you're clumping things into groups of three, all of those rhetorical tricks have the effect of making something feel solid. As in the example I mentioned earlier, you can bundle things that actually have no logical connection together at all into a speech, and make them sound like they're, you know, an iron chain, simply by the patterning of words. You know, you put it in a tricolon, or you have a whole series of things introduced by anaphora. You know, I believe X, I believe Y, I believe Z, I believe, you know, and those things suddenly feel achieved and solid and structurally coherent. But they may not be, logically speaking. And there's your fuzzy logic. So you get the logical bit in the middle, and then generally the peroration of most speeches is where you try and just leave the audience with a tune that they can whistle. And so you think, what? And often it'll be, you know, it'll be the bit which, you know, you end up punching the air going, USA, 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 USA. Or, you know, that's why.
It's coming home.
It's coming home. It's the good vibe, or the, you know, or it might be a bad vibe. It might be, it might be Lock Her Up, but it might even be, you know, a sort of Churchillian moment where it's sort of, unless we act now, you know, one by one, the lights across the European continent are going to wink out, and the earth will enter an unfathomable phase of darkness from which it may never, ever recover.
Is that a direct quote?
No, that's a kind of mishmash of various Churchill quotes. But I mean, he did say...
That's a stirring line.
But he did say the lights are going out all over Europe. And he had another lovely line about silent, mournful, abandoned, broken Czechoslovakia retreats into the darkness.
Silent, mournful, broken. That's amazing.
And So yeah, sometimes it'll be like, you know, we really have to send up Bruce Willis to stop the meteorite or all we're fucked. And, you know, you'll be wanting to emphasize the fuckness rather than the success of the meteorite in your peroration because you're trying to get, scare people into action.
Right.
So it's not always a happy or triumphant or excited thought, but the peroration tends to be where, you know, you put down the moon music, and often it's where you use your most flowery phrases and you know, the high style comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew. Sorry, I'm swearing a lot. I hope that's not...
Oh, absolutely fine.
No, right, good.
Matthew Dix. Are you familiar with him?
So I'm just constantly losing my vape and...
No, you're right.
...wriggling around for it. Matthew Dix?
Yes. He wrote a book called Story Worthy. He won the Moth Storytelling Competition many times. And he was actually, like we were saying before when playing ping pong, like he was a surprise out of nowhere... standout guest. There is a very, very devoted fans of him. He's a school teacher in America, but he is this phenomenal storyteller. Anyway, not one word of ethos, pathos, logos, or traditional rhetoric speech in his book. But then speaking to him about it and thinking about it now, although storytelling is a big part of good speeches, a story on its own right doesn't necessarily require the other elements of a good speech, because you're not necessarily trying to draw someone in a certain direction. You're just trying to captivate them and entertain them for a short amount of time. It's just an observation.
No,
that
I think,
occurred
I think,
to me.
I mean, stories are very powerful in rhetoric, certainly. I think partly that's because we think, and you know, here you head off into deep waters of kind of, you know, speculative cognitive psychology, but you know, we do think in patterns. As Aristotle kind of recognizes, and we have sort of set forms of argument and ideas, and we have, as any number of structural narratologists have observed, kind of set patterns to stories, you know, and people who improvise stories or storytellers, you know, they will, you know, there'll be a hero's journey, or there'll be, you know, there are ways of holding a story together whereby you reintroduce certain elements, just like the way jokes are structured. And so these kind of archetypal shapes, you know, we're kind of like pre-programmed to respond to them and to receive them. And so sort of archetypal shapes of argument and archetypal forms of story are engaging. I mean, your purpose in telling a story is when you're just telling a story as a storyteller, is not necessarily to what rhetoric has, which is often a call to action. But it does depend to some extent on identification. You know, you want an audience to invest in it and to go along with you and to give a shit about the characters. And, you know, in rhetoric, exactly the same thing's going on. You want an audience to invest in the character. The character might be you. The character might be the person you're trying to get thrown in jail, whatever it is, you know. But yeah, heroes, villains, all those things work very well in storytelling, as in rhetoric. I think there's a huge amount of overlap.
I loved that line from the Churchill speech you just drew up. Do you have a short list of favorite lines from speeches ready to go?
Oh God, top of my head, no. I love and often quote the one I quoted earlier from Julius Caesar, the "I am no orator as Brutus is, but as you know me, all a plain blunt man," because it's so outrageous.
Plain blunt man.
I think there are some of those bits in... there are some of the lesser-known parts of I Have a Dream, the Martin Luther King speech, which I think are terrific. When he, for instance, he has a whole thing about the molehills and mountains. There are bits when he's obviously actually being funny, which you think of that as a very solemn speech, but there are sort of jokes. He was very improvisational. He used a bit. He had a bit about the dream, and he was originally delivering a different speech called Cancelled Check, and I think at least folk memories and folk singer Mahalia Jackson said, "Go on, Martin, tell him, do the dream bit." So he went, "All right." I mean, he was very improvisational, because, you know, he would just stand in a folk pulpit and... Yeah.
Pure charisma,
but also a very, very serious kind of no-shit improvisational skill. In I Have a Dream, he has a whole bit that's a kind of riff on Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, where he says, the hill and mountain made low. And there's a sort of Blakean thing of the mountain of despair. And he establishes these kind of in the speech of the architect. And then he has this anaphron, let freedom ring. And he says, let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, the curvaceous slopes of California, Stone Mountain of Georgia, Lookout Mountain of Tennessee, and every hill and molehill of Mississippi. And I think molehill there is kind of brilliant, yeah, because it's it can't not be a funny word.
Right.
You know, in this context, he's these biblical rhetoric, he's all these mountains, and he's enjoying himself with ever more kind of baroque descriptions of these various mountains all over the country. And then you see every hill and molehill. I don't know. Maybe Mississippi is much flatter than these other states. Yeah. But it just seems to me that that has not only the effect of being, you know, being funny, or at least having the confidence to treat something which is of the utmost importance in this speech. You know, I mean, this is a speech about something that is fundamental to the lives and dignity of millions and millions of Black Americans and, you know, for whom many, including Martin Luther King, have themselves suffered and been jailed and been squirted with water hoses and attacked with dogs and all sorts of, you know, really, really horrible shit has gone on. And what's amazing about that speech is that it is uplifting and it's optimistic and it has the confidence to even laugh at some of its own oratory. You know, he's having fun in a weird way. He's really having fun there. You know, I think what was effective about that speech was that it gave hope because it was so sort of, you know, confident.
Right.
You know, it was "we shall overcome." You know, he believed he had the arc of providence on his side, which helps.
And in the book, there is some of the great Churchill lines.
Yeah, there's lots of good Churchill in there. Well, there is a line that we should fight them on the beaches. You know, that very famous bit, fight them on the beaches, fight them on the landing places, so forth. I think the story goes that the radio just cut off briefly before that his next line, which doesn't go down into history, is, we'll throw broken bottles at the bastards if we have to.
Really?
And there's the Churchill thing that I always think, which is famous Churchill line, which is indicative of the extent to which, like, rhetoric is made by the audience, and you know, it's what you hear, so not so much as what they say. His most famous line about blood, sweat, and tears. He never said blood, sweat, and tears. He said blood, sweat, toil, and tears.
No.
But it was basically smoothed by memory into a better phrase, because blood, sweat, and tears is metaphorically coherent because
it's all cliche now.
Yeah, it is, but. But A, it's a tricolon. It's a group of three. We somehow, for reasons that I have never got to the bottom of, I did even write to a couple of, you know, neuroscientists when it was coming out, saying, "Do we know why we grouping things in groups of three?
Or it's just survivorship bias?
Yeah,
that's the way we've always heard it. Therefore, that's what we respond."
Well,
to.
maybe, but certainly triads seem to be the thing. But anyway, so it's a group of three, and it's, you know, toil is the only one that isn't a bodily fluid. So, you know, we basically. The grand, you know, march of historical amnesia has just pebble-like kind of smoothed that into a better phrase.
Nice. We are running up on time. You've been very generous, giving me so much
time. Not at
all.
Well, thank you for...
Oh, no, I'm not wrapping it up yet.
Oh, good. Good.
Can you do maybe three or four quick more questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, absolutely. Were there any speeches in doing your research that you know of which were extremely significant and had huge potential, but were butchered in their delivery and therefore the significance of them lost?
Oh, God, off the top of my head. I'm sorry, it's such a long time since I've done this. I can't immediately think of a great... I mean, I think there's a survivorship issue in that one as well, which is we don't generally remember the great speeches that were badly delivered. There are... Good, you know, there are dodgily written speeches that are well delivered. I mean, you know, the Philip Collins, who I mentioned earlier, always liked to point out, and I, you know, have to give him credit where it's due for the observation. He said that the famous line in Kennedy's first inaugural, where he says, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So it's an absolutely brilliant line. Mm. But the whole of that speech up until that point had been about foreign policy. and obviously there's absolutely nothing that you can do for your country. He said a complete logical disconnect. It worked beautifully because it sounded great. Mm. And it, you know, draws the audience in. It says, you know, we're all in this together. But, you know, honestly, you know, it didn't have any logical connection to the rest of the speech, which is all about you know, the Cold War.
You're a podcast host. Do you ever consciously think about any tips of rhetoric that could help you when either interviewing a person or just communicating to people through a microphone?
I wish I was more conscious of that. I think I instinctively find myself using anaphora a lot, because when you can't think of what to say next, you often think, well, start the sentence, what have you said previously? I mean, it's more that I catch myself in tics rather than anything else. No, my podcast tends to be a sort of rambling conversation. I'm generally focusing, in as much as I've got a plan, on the content of the book under discussion. Mm-hmm. And also the sort of podcast I host is one where I'm essentially trying to get authors to talk rather than talk myself. So I'm generally just asking, you know, I'm not trying to show off on my podcast.
Book Club by The Spectator.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. It's really good.
Thank you.
Really good. I was listening on the way over to, I actually don't know the guy's name, but he'd written a book about speeches, great speeches. Listen to one.
That might have been Philip Collins, or either Phil Collins. I wrote one of, I spoke to him about great speeches.
Speeches that shape the world.
I think that's Phil's book. I also spoke to a guy called Joe Heinrichs, who did a book called How to Argue with Your Cat. He's another of my colleagues in the groves of rhetoric.
Then perhaps some advice for me. How can I use the lessons of good rhetoric to better convince my audience to share with people, to leave reviews, etc.?
Well, I think you do very well in coming across as trustworthy and likable, which obviously is number one. I think, you know, how do you persuade your audience to leave likes and reviews? Unfortunately, if I had an instant answer to that, I'd have more listeners to my podcast than I do. I guess actually the only rhetorical thing that I have noticed that has helped me on my podcast, which I suppose is a sort of ethos thing, is I make a point of always reading my guests' books.
Mm.
And because a lot of those guests are used to being interviewed by, you know, radio hosts who are very harried and haven't bothered to read their books or have had it briefed for them, it's amazing how much an interviewee will open up and feel appreciated and loved if you have clearly, you know, read the book and are asking questions. You know, you say, on page 395, you say this. And they're instantly like, oh, they've actually, oh,
they've read
that. Because it means, you know, I think that works in an ethos appeal in the same way, in ways, you know, you're in a small town and you know, you're a presidential candidate and you're in a tiny town, you compliment their local baseball team because they're all like, oh, he's found out about our baseball. He likes our baseball. Oh, he likes our town. He takes an interest in us.
Yeah.
And so I think that an ethos appeal to that extent can be a personal connection between two people just as much as it might be between one person and audience. Well, you know, we're accustomed to thinking of rhetoric as a big thing to a large audience. Mm. But actually that's just the sort of tradition of formal speech making. You know, rhetoric is, as I, you know, hope I argue in the book, and I hope I've at least hinted here, is present everywhere there is persuasion. And, you know, there's a lot of persuasion is one-on-one.
Mm.
You know, there's probably a whole other book to be written on the rhetoric of getting someone to come on a Tinder date with you.
True. Absolutely. So you're so brazen as to say, when you do sit across from someone, like, on page 234, you had this magnificent quote, as like a wink to them, or surely because your job is a literary critic and editor, they sort of know Sam's got an extremely erudite understanding, not only of my book, but, you know, the books that surrounds it.
No, I think people are always pleasantly surprised if a radio interview has read the book. I mean, I won't generally be quite as unsubtle as saying it's magnificent. I mean, I think it's generally polite to say if you've enjoyed the book, and if you haven't, to say you found it interesting. I don't generally consciously, you know, use a page reference or something, but it's not like I think, okay, in the first 5 minutes of this, I'm going to quote them directly back at themselves just to prove I've read it.
But
it's
you more are just thinking in the beginning, I want to somehow signal to him that I've read it.
Not really. I mean, I'm describing results really rather than a deliberate project.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I bother to read the books is because I don't think the conversation is generally nearly as worth having if you haven't.
Absolutely.
But an accidental byproduct of that is that the
you're doing DJ.
You know,
radio
I've just noticed that. You know, it really helps in terms of opening up, and that's a sort of pleasant side effect of, you know, bothering to do your homework properly.
Do you think that, rather than let me ask you, I'll just say my opinion. I think the podcasting is terrific in terms of adding legitimate, in terms of raising the standards for radio, right? Because where else would you actually get such intimate interviews with authors from a host who actually is interested in them? And the reason you know he's interested in them is because he's the curator of the entire show. He's not a host of a show that other people are curating for him.
No, I think that's absolutely, and that's a change. I mean, I think it's changed the grammar of radio a bit in two ways. One of them is absolutely, as you say, that particularly those ones which, like yours and like mine, are kind of basically one man bands. Mm. You know, you're getting one person's sensibility and interests. I mean, my case, it's not purely my sensibility, it's which new books am I thinking our readers are going to be interested in or whatever. Mm. But you got one person. But the other one is because, and it's a, you know, follows up what we were saying about the internet not being entirely composed of tiny things. You know, almost no, like, broadcast radio show.
Right, that's true.
Has more than 5 or 10 minutes for an author interview. Yeah. Absolute tops. I mean, it's, you know, Kazuo Ishiguro, after he's won his Nobel Prize, might get a half-hour special if he's bloody lucky.
True.
With three ad breaks. But on, you know, podcasting allows you to go on for hours and hours and hours, which, I mean, it has disadvantages because some podcasts go on for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
And it's also invented a sort of kind of hybrid between a traditional radio and those kind of drive time, you know, old fashioned radio shows where you just had a couple of slightly wacky guys like burbling on at each other and playing records for 4 hours, you know, on a Thursday afternoon. But it does allow that thing, which people obviously really dig, of quite often podcasts that are just a couple of people or three people who just, you get to just listen to them shooting the shit, and they'll maybe have a vague subject that they like to talk about, you know, politics or history sport. Or whatever, or sport.
That's the entirety of all the whole sports genre.
Yeah. You just get these guys chatting. You're
there because of cricket, but you might go 2 hours without mentioning cricket.
Yeah. So it's much less structured. And I'm kind of, in some ways, a bit surprised because I find I get bored just having my own conversation for 2 hours. The idea of wanting to listen to somebody else just talking shit for 2 hours, you know.
Yeah.
But people do, and I think it's because there's an ethos thing there, because you feel there's a sort of quality of intimacy to it. Mm. You get to feel that these people are friends, and if you listen to, you know, my old friends Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook doing the Rest Is History podcast,
yeah, great one.
Usually successful, and they. It's because they are two incredibly knowledgeable guys. I mean, my God, if I had the recall for facts and dates and themes that either Tom or Dom have, I would, you know, retire happy. Yeah, they both know everything, and if they don't know it, they can read a book and they remember it instantly. Mm. You know, for me, I'm like, I read a book and I know all about that book for about 3 or 4 days tops, and then it's gone. Even my own books. But you know, you've got like these two very erudite and amusing and slightly weird guys just chatting to each other about history, and you learn something, and you're kind of invited into the Tom and Dom living room. And I think, you know, that's kind of classic sort of podcast format that works.
Yeah, that is an amazing one. That is an amazing one. Okay. If you could go back and be present at one speech in history.
Oh, one speech. Yeah. That's a good one. I think I probably... I mean, I'm not going to go very far off the beaten track here because, you know, the old is the goodies. It wouldn't be the Gettysburg Address because, by all accounts, almost nobody who was there could even hear him. And it only went on for 2.5 minutes. So I think it would be a bit of a letdown to stand at the back and just... Okay, it would be like that Monty Python sketch where they're like, blessed are the cheesemakers.
Yes.
So I think the Gettysburg Address would be deeply underwhelming. I think being somewhere near the front for I Have a Dream would be pretty cool. Mm. And actually, I wouldn't half mind having been in Grant Park for Obama's victory speech.
Okay.
Because that...
It was a good one?
Oh, it was amazing. Go look it up. And I mean, it was slightly kind of chilling because he delivered it in Grant Park, Chicago, between two enormous... They were like the goals for American football fields, you know, those big kind of Y-shaped things. And they were bulletproof glass. Because at this stage, they were like, first black president, some lunatic's going to have a pop at him with a high-velocity rifle, aren't they? So it was kind of had that slight frisson of it. But it was tremendously moving. And he tells a story. He tells the story of Anne Nixon Cooper, I think she was called, who was a black woman who had, I think, been born... I don't think she would have been old enough to have been born into slavery, but had you know, first generation after slavery, and had been through all of the civil rights stuff in the South, and had, you know, had lived through, she was 92 or something, and had lived through all of America's terrible racial history. And true. It described how she was voting and how she had voted. Yep. And I don't think she voted for the first time, but it was
incredible. Yeah.
It was an amazing story that kind of personalized, and he was like, that's who we do it
wow,
for.
Wow, you know.
And you get that. I mean, I think being at one of those speeches where you kind of know this is history and the speaker nails it, that's got to be a thrill.
Mm. Why doesn't Barack use his gift of oratory post-presidential career more?
That's a good question. I think he does. I think it's not reported as much because he's not... I mean, I think he gives...
Where's he doing it?
He gives your speech. He does his charitable foundations and things. He's not intervening in politics, partly because I think he doesn't want to be what, you know, retired cops sometimes get called uncles. You know, they always turn up at the cop shop, you know, hoping to get the cops. I think, he doesn't want to overshadow his successor. You know, he likes Biden. I think, you know, you don't want to... Generally, ex-prime ministers and ex-presidents... I think good manners says you don't be a spare wheel.
Mm.
You know, you don't want to start, you know, being if Obama was making political speeches all the time, for a start, he'd get all the attention. There'd be a whole lot of, oh, why is he doing so much better than Biden? Why can't Biden do it this well? You know, there'd be a whole, I think, you know, with very good reason, he doesn't generally get involved in politics anymore. But
I mean, obviously we're not inside the political apparatus, but what Biden lacks in most is charisma in public speaking.
Yeah.
Imagine if his old buddy Barack, who is exceptional at it, could, you know, do some of the heavy lifting here.
Well, no, he couldn't, precisely because you can only do your own heavy lifting. You know, if Barack were doing the heavy lifting for Biden, what you'd see is a 10-stone weakling having his suitcase carried by...
Right.
You know, by the big muscly guy,
which
would make him look even weaker. I mean, Biden isn't a great orator. He's
he's shocking. No,
he's not good.
You end up kind of chuckling at him or feeling pity for him.
Yeah,
every time.
No, I think he's not good. But there is no way, unfortunately, that Obama would do anything other than make his situation worse if he popped up and started being the prince across the water. And of course, he can't. You know, there's a term limit and. You know, maybe what happens is Trump gets in again, abolishes all term limits, abolishes the rules you can only be a two-term president, attempts to install himself as dictator for life, and Barack is then able to come back and save us.
I want that timeline. That'd be something else. All right,
I'm not sure.
Sam, two more ask this to every single guest, and so it's completely non-rhetoric related.
Okay, great.
The first being, what is the role that serendipity has played in your life?
Serendipity. Well, I think with pure serendipity that I met my wife. So that obviously has been the decisive
Pure serendipity? Do you
pure serendipity. Well, we happened to be at the same party together, and I nearly didn't go to the party, and she nearly didn't go to the party. And, you know, like, we were both really, really drunk, which was also serendipitous. So that you know, that certainly played... I mean, I think serendipity plays a part throughout my life. I mean, to be honest, my career was quite dramatically changed. I was a gossip columnist, and I ended up going to be a New York correspondent because of 9/11. And my, I mean, this book about rhetoric I wrote by chance because an article I'd written about Barack Obama, because serendipitously I got interested in rhetoric at university. Serendipitously, I got interested in Obama just the time when I was fired from a newspaper and had newly become freelance. So I was able to write a piece for the FT about Obama's rhetoric in 2008. By serendipity, that piece happened to fall into the hands of a book publisher who said, oh, I think there's a book in this.
Okay.
So I was very lucky in that. No, I've been lucky all through my life. But yeah, serendipity has mostly been good for me, I think, so far.
I love it. And that is the most common response, particularly with the life partner.
Yeah.
That is...
It's always chance that you mean. always chance. Yeah.
Absolutely. Although less so now. Yeah, these... I imagine in 50 years, if I'm asking the same question to a bunch of people, it will be...
Oh, they'd all have met through an algorithm.
Well, it's an algorithm. Yeah. Because it matches you, because you swipe right on some and left on others.
Yeah. It's actually an algorithm. No, but it was literally like I'd been out the night before and I'd had an absolutely horrible night, and... I so nearly didn't go to this birthday party, and she likewise. And so that was...
And here you are.
And here we are, yeah.
Three kids.
Exactly.
All right, mate, last question.
Uh-huh.
Again, super non-rhetoric related. But what is a country you're particularly bullish on?
Bullish? You mean what country do I think is about to...
Bright future.
Has a bright future. Oh, boy. You do ask the difficult questions, don't you? I mean, you know, speaking as like somebody who is incredibly ignorant about global economics and politics, I mean, I would have to say, I think it's China's looking pretty good. nice. Everyone says that, don't they? I know, I'm not very bullish on Russia. I'm less bullish on Ukraine than I was a year ago, as unfortunately all of us are. No, I think everywhere looks pretty terrible. I think of countries I know or like. I'm like, you know, it's okay. Lebanon, no. South Africa, no. Israel, triple no. You know, Russia, triple no. The UK, screwed. America's looking terrible. No, I think we're all doomed, really.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's uncanny, Sam, how...
Everyone says the same thing.
Everyone says the same thing. So I've done 4 interviews in 2 days.
Uh-huh.
Not one person... could just pick out a country and say, you know what, I think they've got a good future. Whereas 2 years ago, everyone had a few countries top of mind. And so just as a, you know, non-data-driven signal of what people's general sentiment is, it is not sunny, which is, you know, rather depressing.
Well, the trouble is, I mean, obviously because regional disturbances just translate, don't they? I mean, I'm sure there are a handful of African countries that are beginning to prosper because they're starting from a low bar and, you know, climate change hasn't really started to bite yet. But, you know, I mean, okay, the Middle East is screwed. America's, you know, it looks like losing its republic, and everywhere else is, you know, dependent on America.
Yeah.
Eastern Europe's in all sorts of trouble. Europe, you know... America catches a cold, Europe sneezes. I mean, Maybe South America. Maybe it's fucking great in Uruguay.
Australia.
Well, Australia's kind of okay, isn't it?
We're kind of not immune, obviously.
You're not immune.
But much further downstream from a lot of these problems.
Yeah, you've got a bit of the fash down there, but with a bit of the fash all over everywhere, aren't there? And
a bit of the fash? Fascism?
Yeah.
Okay.
But... Who's yeah, Australia seems like a nice place. I thought there was a bit of a hard right thing going on in the States. A lot of kind of anti-immigration sentiment and the sort of
we've always
fish
had
chip
that.
Shop stuff. But
we've always had that.
But fortunately, actually, you know.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I'm not optimistic. But there again, I don't, you know, I'm not one of those people who... I spend a lot of time reading the news, so obviously, because of all the cognitive biases...
You're not talking to the mic anymore.
Oh, sorry. Obviously, I spent a lot of time reading the news, so because of all the biases we know about in the news... No, Kat, don't knock that over. I will tend to have a less than rosy view of the world, because, you know, if it bleeds, it leads.
Sam, loved the book. There's an updated version. There'll be a link to your podcast, the book as well, and... I just can't thank you enough for being so generous with your time. And
thank you. I'm very honored to be on your podcast in such distinguished company. Thanks, thank you.